also flowed. In what does the substance of those reproaches lie? It lies in the fact that an historic character like Alexander I, standing on the highest possible pinnacle of human power with the blinding light of history focused upon him, a character exposed to those strongest of all influences, the intrigues, flattery, and self-deception inseparable from power, a character who at every moment of his life felt a responsibility for all that was happening in Europe, and not a fictitious but a live character, who like every man had his personal habits, passions, and impulses towards goodness, beauty, and truth, that this character, though not lacking in virtue, the historians do not accuse him of that, had not the same conception of the welfare of humanity 50 years ago as a present-day professor who from his youth upwards has been occupied with learning, that is, with books and lectures, and with taking notes from them. But if we assume that 50 years ago Alexander I was mistaken in his view of what was good for the people, we must inevitably assume that the historian who judges Alexander will also, after the lapse of some time, turn out to be mistaken in his view of what is good for humanity. This assumption is all the more natural and inevitable because, watching the movement of history, we see that every year, and with each new writer, opinion as to what is good for men.